The Breakfast Club.
Adam White is our weather guru around here. He should know a fair bit about this. Good morning, Whitey.
Yes, good morning. It is, absolutely. There was almost a bit of coolness to the coolness. To the air this morning as I walked out to my car. A bit of crisp, bit crisp. Considering it's going to be 30 today, but again, when there's no cloud cover, it tends to be a bit cooler in the morning.
Yeah, no, I didn't notice that. I mean, shorts and a T-shirt today is not unusual apparel for me.
No, it's not unusual.
In the morning, I didn't feel the nip in the air, as they say.
Because it's going to be, I mean, again, we're going off the bureau here, so anything's possible.
Oh,
but
there's been a turn.
No,
look,
I'm
at
very
you.
Cynical about them.
Look at
they
you.
They are down on confidence. That
well, I think
be
you're
disputed.
Down on confidence.
Well, I am down on confidence because I do have, have had trust. Arkwright of Open All Hours.
What's that?
The television program in the, I think you'd say 70s and 80s, Open All Hours with Ronnie Barker.
Oh, yes.
And Arkwright was Ronnie Barker's character, and he had the sort of, you know.
A little impediment.
You don't know? You've never seen that? Well, don't tell me you haven't seen that show either.
Well, no, I haven't. Well, I'm sure I probably have 35 years ago. Sure, I probably have for a little while, but not in the recent time.
Well, you wouldn't, if you didn't know that Arkwright spoke like that, then you wouldn't have seen that show.
Well, I might have when I was about 2.5. But that was a long time ago, yeah, as you well know.
Maybe. Did you see in your holidays, did you see?
No. I know what you're going to say.
What?
You're going to say The Office.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the answer's no.
Then you're going to tell me that you didn't have time.
No, I didn't.
Jeez.
Too busy resting. Trying to get some, regenerate my battery for another big year in the Breakfast
Club.
Well,
and then I'm already needing a holiday. day four. The upshot is, yeah, the bureau is very disappointing. But but it's meant to be 30, 31, 33, up to 35 on Sunday.
36 on Sunday. I know that. 3:10, the middle of the day when the Blues are playing. That's
right.
Going to be peak period.
We're about to be playing on Sunday.
Yeah, the world's most open event and affair at the Witten Oval.
Oh, right.
A lot of sun coverage over there. So, well, yeah, that's going to be warm, I would have thought. But the weekend's going to be hot. Good for the. Although, we heard in the build-up to the Australian Open kicking off the start of the week, Craig Gabriel was whinging about no sunshine, no summer. Well, the wet bulb will be out.
Yes.
Big time. They'll find the key to the cupboard. Maybe that's the same key that opens the prize cupboard here.
Possibly.
I reckon you might be onto something there. So the wet bulb's going to be required because it's going to be super hot. Are you disappointed that it's got to this point with you and the bomb? Because you were such a staunch supporter.
Well, where do you go from here?
You were such a staunch
supporter. Where do you
supporter.
Go from here? If you can't trust the bureau, where do you go?
I don't know.
Seriously?
No, I don't know. I'm serious.
Because if you didn't trust the bureau, who do you trust when it comes to weather?
Well, my number nerd at Carlton, who does all the stats, not the sort of the high performance GPS and that sort of stuff. He's a real like nerd, smart dude. He's got this app that he subscribes to, that he says to me. Now he wouldn't like because he's too big of a nerd. Is 100% accurate.
Is that the one with the parrot that chirps?
No, I don't know. But I didn't ask too much detail because I don't really care. But he says to me, it is 100% on the money all the time, and it evolves, but its forecasts are legitimately accurate forecasts.
Mm.
You got to pay for it, but I don't know why the bureau wouldn't be giving us that sort of stuff. Mm. Your mates at the bureau.
But it is a good question, though. If you can't trust the bureau, who can you trust when it comes to the weather?
That's a good question.
Mm.
That's a good question. Would you trust? Because Jane goes outside the bureau, doesn't she?
Well, I think she's gone a bit rogue.
She's gone a bit rogue.
I think
my understanding.
Yeah. Mm.
That's my understanding on that. But I want to track down Simon Dool, one of our favourites in the world of New Zealand cricket commentary. He's commentating the Under-19 World Cup in Dubai at the moment, but he's keen to chat to us about the cancelled New Zealand tour of Australia. So that's good business for us. So we'll get to him right now. Simon, good morning.
Daniel, Adam, how are you, boys?
We are well, mate. How are you tracking there at the Under-19 World Cup just while we're there?
Yeah, all right, actually. Thank you. It's Trinidad. I'm in Trinidad at the moment. It's been played across, where are we? St. Kitts and Nevis, Trinidad. We were in Guyana last week. and we head to Antigua for the final week. I think the Aussies are in a game today. They're involved against Scotland as we speak, and I'm just doing the India-Ireland game in Trinidad at the moment. So it's all going well, mate. Nice to always get a little look at the up-and-coming talent, the future talent to keep an eye out for.
Who's the team to beat?
I can tell you. Well, Australia looking good, actually. I hate saying it, but they look good, and India look very good at the moment. There's a young kid called Teague Wiley who's just brought up 100. I think he's 101 not out, as Aussie have just beaten Scotland today. He got runs in the first game that were really, really good. We gave him man of the match in Australia's first game as well, and he looked outstanding. So he's been very impressive from an Australian point of view. So maybe in a couple of years' time, one to keep an eye out for.
How many months of a year now are you away from home, Simon? Every time I turn on the TV, you're commentating somewhere around the world, and it's not usually New Zealand.
Well, if you're thinking New Zealand's home still, it's probably, well, it's not anymore, but I was last home on January the 7th last year.
Right.
So I spent the whole of last year travelling and working. And pandemic-wise, it's just been a nightmare because of what New Zealand's sort of gone through. I mean, I know you guys have gone through, all this quarantine and 14 days. Normally I would have headed home in between gigs, but when you've got a quarantine in a hotel for 14 days and you get home for 3 or 4 days, then you've got to fly back out again. It just hasn't been any point, mate. So it's been a tough old time. But having said that, there's a lot of people who got through a lot worse than I have, and I've still had a job for a long time. So a lot of people have suffered a lot more than that over the last year and a bit, haven't they? As we all know.
Yeah, exactly right. And you talk about quarantine, and it's largely the reason why New Zealand aren't going to come to Australia for this one-day series, because New Zealand would have to come over here, but then the quarantine meant that it was almost not worth it. But, I mean, in a way, Simon, the good players weren't necessarily going to be coming anyway.
No, they weren't. And that's been, that's one of the things about the schedule, I suppose, at the moment, and about this. You know, the bubbles, the biosecure bubbles that we're all sort of getting so used to now, quarantine periods, sort of waiting in hotels for tours to start, they're having to find that they need to give certain players, or all the players at some stage, a rest. So you figure out what is, I guess, dare I say it, what is the least important.
Yep.
So you think now and you think, well, world tournaments, world test championship games, those are the most important ones that are going to get most of the focus. And the other things, sadly, in this time, probably just going to take a bit of a back seat, which, it seemed to be the way that New Zealand cricket were looking at this short tour of Australia. But to go over there and then have to come back and do 10 days at the moment in hotel quarantine, they've reduced that from 14. At the time when New Zealand agreed to the tour, there was no quarantine. There was an open, an open bubble between New Zealand and Australia, and that's all changed again.
So do you think going forward that this is going to be a problem for New Zealand cricket, or is it just the fact that because it's a local bubble that we're sort of dealing with from an Australasian perspective, that that's the only barrier that will stop them touring?
I think it's going to be a problem moving forward, and I think the government there's been no end game for New Zealand's government, and I know around the world Jacinda Ardern has a very good reputation, but in New Zealand that reputation has gone from sky high to zero very, very quickly in the last sort of six or eight months. I know she's seen around the world as someone who has, done the right thing. And I think New Zealand were probably put up as a bit of a poster child in the early part of the pandemic. But now we're lagging behind. There is absolutely no end game. They still think they can control COVID or not let COVID in, whereas a lot of countries are now learning to deal with it and live with it, and their economies are starting to bounce back. So I think it's going to be a really tough time for New Zealand still in the next 6-8 months, even maybe to a year, to get people to tour there. This Women's World Cup's going to be tough. I mean, we've got our crew, a lot of our crew that are here in the Caribbean with us at the moment are struggling to even contemplate going to the Women's World Cup to do that 10 days hotel quarantine now. So it's not easy.
No, it's a nightmare for everyone involved, I would have thought. Was there anyone you were looking forward to seeing against Australia? It was Whitey said that some of the bigger names perhaps wouldn't be a part of the series, so there would have been opportunities for the next generation maybe of New Zealand talent to come through. Was there anyone that you were looking forward to seeing?
I just think when you look through what New Zealand have tried, and I mean, obviously with Ross Taylor departing, and we're almost at that point where you're looking at picking a second team or having two teams touring at certain stages. And I know Australia have done this with a T20 side somewhere and a test match side in other areas. I think there's some real talent coming through in this New Zealand ranks, but you want to be able to see these guys kick on, get to the next level, the Seiferts, the Mark Chapmans, these sort of guys who are given limited opportunities, you know, in that in the World Cup and the build-up to the World Cup. Those are the sort of guys you really want to see kick on. And, you know, these are the tours that I think when you know it's going to be tough in Australia. And these are the ones where you find out a little bit more about them, a little bit about their mettle and whether they can cope at that next level up, because we can't always rely, you know, on the Conways and the Williamsons and the Bolts and the Southies and things to do those jobs. So it would have been a really good tour for some of those up-and-coming players and to get a bit of a gauge and an idea on how they would go at that next level. But, yeah, sadly, you know, sadly for those guys as well, because they would have certainly been looking forward to it. It's not a player's decision.
Yeah.
It's got to be taken out of their hands by New Zealand cricket and the government. And, you know, I mean, the players would probably happily do the 10 days quarantine, but they couldn't be guaranteed a hotel spot on the way back. And they might have got stuck in Australia, and you guys might have claimed a couple like you have done in the past.
Hey, I know we haven't got a lot of time with you, Simon, because you've got to head off. It's a good call, actually, by the way. But just quickly, what cricket have New Zealand now got? Because they've just come off that test series with Bangladesh, which was a sort of a mixed result. But what's ahead for New Zealand?
South Africa are meant to be touring for the rest of the summer. And then the Netherlands are going for a short tour as well. So that's what New Zealand have got to look forward to at home. Again, it's sort of, you know, that situation where you think, well, you just hope that South Africa do go. I think February 17th
yep.
to March the 1st, that tour is supposed to be a test match in Christchurch and a test match in Wellington for South Africa. And then the Netherlands tour New Zealand late to mid to late March and play a T20 and 3 1-day internationals. So, you know, so that's what New Zealand have got to look forward to for the rest of the summer. But the other thing about, you know, New Zealand not touring or teams not touring New Zealand, it sort of really puts the World Test Championship ODI Championship and the qualification for the next World Cup, all of these things really come into play. And, you know, they're sort of, I guess they're making a rod for their own back a little bit if they continue to miss out on these situations. And, you know, they don't get some help from the government along the way.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And the final one, just on, we've been talking about the Big Bash a bit here and whether it's succeeding or not. Now, it's very difficult to tell because of COVID and crowds, you know, not going and all that sort of thing. But for someone that does travel the world playing cricket, are we seeing too much cricket? Have we got the balance right? Or what are your thoughts on how it's all sort of playing out at the moment? More so that domestic or franchise cricket?
Yeah, look, there's a huge amount of it. I really enjoyed the Big Bash in the early couple of years. I believe I've lengthened it too much. I think it's too long now, and I think that's part of the reason. I know the pandemic's part of the reason as well, but it's also part of the reason that the players, some of the big-named international players, didn't want to go back. Mm. So I think Cricket Australia got that wrong, but I thought the tournament at the start was brilliant. Is there too much franchise cricket? Well, I almost think that's the way that we're going to see things go. And we might just see players picking and choosing a little bit more with a beat between country and franchise, country and club, so to speak. There is going to be a saturation of T20 cricket. What that does do is it gives other players, next-tier players, an opportunity to make some money, you know, for guys that don't perhaps play at the top level. But I know there's quite a few of my colleagues are thinking that in 5, 6, 7 years' time, we might only see 5 or 6 countries playing test cricket. You know, you're definitely going to see Australia or England playing. You'll probably see India. New Zealand I think they're probably a 70-30 chance of continuing to play test cricket. But it doesn't make anybody any money. It makes no countries money except for England, except for Australia. A test tour from India makes a country money, but they prefer to play one day as in T20 international. So, you know, as a business model, if you're talking about does it make us money and is it sustainable, you'd say no. But I think world cricket still needs test cricket. And I think we all love a good test match and we forget very quickly a one-day international result or a T20 result, but we remember for years a great test match, you know, those sorts of situations. So, Look, it's a really hard one. I'd hate to see it go, but I just wonder in 5 to 10 years' time how many countries are actually going to be playing it competitively.
We are exactly where we are. I felt like we've had a really good preparation in Adelaide. We played well. We're able to get through some really tough matches, and Tyres is the master. He's the absolute best in the business. I'm very spoilt to have him in my team and very grateful that he's got the tactical knowledge, he's got the communication, and I think the way that we talk to each other is incredible. He's going to love he's on the big screen right now. But honestly, I feel like our whole team works extremely well together. We're enjoying our tennis and being able to produce some pretty good stuff.
Produce some pretty good stuff. Ash, bang, wallop is the headline of the paper today, inspired by our very own Adam White, was the sub-editor there with the walloping.
She's perfect, isn't she? The way she plays, the way she talks, the way she brings everyone into her team and appreciation.
There's an element of Ash, come on, let's give us a spell.
Yeah, that's right.
In that way,
too
it was
perfect.
Well, that, but she also gave us, we are exactly where we are. At the start of that. Did you hear that?
I don't think that quite came out properly.
Way too good for Bronzetti yesterday. 6-1, 6-1, the world number one and number one seed for the Australian Open. And she was very, very good and set the place alight yesterday on day three. Craig Gabriel is watching it all unfold. He's with us. Hello, Craig.
Morning. You just used the word perfect. I just wonder then if Ed Sheeran wrote perfect for Ash.
Well, it's a great question. It's one I've been contemplating for quite some time now.
I thought you were.
Well, as you're a good friend of Ed, you just ring him up and ask him.
He has been busy with his pub or whatever it was he bought just next door to his house in the UK. So I didn't want to disturb him. And then Elton John turns up and, you know, the conversation goes all over the place. Elton only wants to talk about Billie Jean King and I'm not interested and all that. So, yeah.
He gets so boring sometimes, Elton, just talking about all that stuff. Had enough of him. Who else sang that song perfect?
He did it with Beyonce.
Fairground Attraction is what it was. We'll get that. We'll put that up at the end of this, just for all those playing at home. We're digressing a little bit.
Yes.
Craig, which is unusual for us. But yeah. She was pretty good yesterday, Ash. We spoke about her first round performance and how clinical that was, but we didn't see anything to suggest that has tapered off in the second round.
Well, look, let's see what happens. And I'm not taking anything away from Ash. You can only play who's across the net from you. And she's come up against a couple of players that... if she had lost more than two or three games in a set, we'd be questioning what's going on. I mean, they're not highly experienced or anything like that in playing on places like Rod Laver Arena. But I also feel the important aspect of this is that she's able to conserve energy because the matches are going to get tougher and they could go quite long. So you want to have that energy in the bag and be able to use it when it's really necessary. And, you know, maybe she'll come up against Naomi Osaka in another round. So, you know, I think it's good the way she started this tournament. She hasn't played a match that's more than 55 minutes. I mean, one was 54, one was 52, and she's lost three games in four sets.
And
in the four sets she's played.
And much to your glee, the weather will be heating up too, so saving energy early in the tournament might be pretty handy later on.
Well, absolutely. You know, that's the point that I'm making because you know how hot it can get over here. I think a few players on the outside courts were feeling it yesterday. I mean, I was not stupid. I stayed inside, so I don't really know. and it was also pretty windy, and that can be frustrating.
Yeah, so straight through to the third, Ash defeating two lowly opponents, in fairness, as Craig says, on her way through. From the other Aussie's perspective, Alexander Vukic went down in his second round encounter, and poor old Johnny Millman copped a pretty good Zverev outing last night. He was very impressive.
Yeah, he did. In 4-4 in love, that was the last night match on Rod Laver Arena, and John wasn't able to get into any sort of stride. Zverev was just right on the money last night, and you're starting to see this confidence aspect with Zverev. I mean, you know, we've spoken about him in the past as to whether he's going to make a breakthrough or not, you know, up and down. But that Olympic gold medal has done him the world of good. He's barely lost a match since then. And he's won a couple of big titles, including the year-end championships, the ATP World Tour Finals in Turin. So all that has really been building up for Zverev, and he was pretty awesome, and that's why he's been one of my two picks for the title.
There's a couple of players I wanted to ask you about, Craig, that we don't know a lot about, but they're coming through. One of them is Sebastian Korda. It's a great story, this whole Korda family with what they're doing.
Is he part of the team?
Amazing.
Yeah, he's the brother of the two female
the brother
golfers.
Of and the son of.
Yeah. How good do you think he could be?
I think he can be incredibly good. I mean, when you look at what the moves that he's made over the last 12 months, it seemed like yesterday that I was talking to him after he won the Australian Open Juniors.
Yeah.
And he's so grounded. He's well-liked. And when you've got parents like he's got, it's hard not to be grounded and well-liked. So, I'd like to see him do incredibly well because I like the family. I mean, Peter, his dad, and I are pretty good friends. So it would be quite amazing if it could be a father-son situation with the Australian Open. I'm not saying it's going to happen this year or next year, but I think he could end up winning the Australian Open at some stage, just like Jess won the Australian Open golf.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter without a second E, of course, Daniel.
Of course.
Yes.
And the other one I want to ask you about is Alcaraz, who's got the great name.
Another great one.
And a great player coming through, quite young. Again, someone that not necessarily a lot of people would know about, but huge upside.
What a clay courter. And the fact is, he is now being able to adapt his game to other surfaces and a hard court. I mean, he hasn't had much experience on grass. Another good kid. And what I'm concerned or afraid of with Carlos is maybe breaking down a little bit. I mean, he's had a couple of injuries, and he's also gone through COVID as well. But wonderful talent, great person with him. He's been coached by Juan Carlos Ferrero, former world number one, the Mosquito, as he used to be known. But wonderful talent. He's got French Open written all over his future resume.
Well, I'm looking forward to finding out more about that young man as he goes through the system. What about back to the women's brigade for a second? My girl, Maria Sakkari, who was very, very good last night, 6-1, 6-4. In fact, they're all the seeds in the women's division yesterday. Did a pretty good job. Didn't have to work too hard. Svitolina had to work a little bit harder, but her opponent, Harmony Tam, was wheeled off in a chair. What happened there?
A leg injury. And the chair umpire, apparently, I didn't hear the conversation, but apparently advised her not to continue playing. And they needed a wheelchair to get her off. I didn't see the actual incident because I was doing the commentary on AO Radio, and I saw the result. And I thought, you waited till 5-1 in the third set to retire? But, yeah, I mean, Elena Svitolina, I was speaking to her afterwards, and she said, yeah, it was a very sad way to finish that match, to have an opponent have to leave the court in a wheelchair.
We're looking forward to the first of the Ashes games between Australia and England. Three T20s to kick it off, a test match, 3 1-days as well, and it's going to be great to see Megan Shute back in the colours for Australia. She joins us on the line. Megan, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good on you. Great to have you with us. We're very excited about your involvement in this series and the series full stop, let alone your involvement. But what's it like to be back after what you've been through from a life perspective in the last couple of months, being back in the colours?
It's refreshing. It had been so long since I'd properly caught up with my Aussie girls. I think it had been April last year, so it felt like a lifetime with a lot of life stuff in between. So really nice to just get back out there, but, you know, with some strange protocols in place and not being able to hug them and whatnot, that was also very strange, but it's just nice to be putting on Aussie kit again, to be honest.
I'm sure there's been plenty of hugs, though, for little Riley in the last little while that you've been able to make up for not hugging your teammates at Riley's copped a few of them.
Yeah, absolutely. That girl is spoilt with love, that's for sure. She doesn't always deserve it, I'll be honest. She's a hug lady, but she's absolutely beautiful and it does not lack love, that's for sure.
Oh, fantastic. So is it nice to be out of the house and have a different focus?
Yeah, it's so different. I knew it was going to be different coming into it, but, obviously a life-changing experience and having a child now, I guess, puts life in a different perspective. And for me, it actually has made me less nervous. I back my skill set enough now that I realise it is just a game of cricket. So Yeah, for me, you know, tables have turned a little bit, but for the positive, I reckon.
Yeah, perspective's a wonderful thing. No doubt parenthood can do that to you. But you are a magnificent cricketer, and your skill set, as you say, is some of the best on the planet. Did you realise how much you missed not playing?
Oh, absolutely. Watching the Indian series was really hard. I'd never really watched us on TV before, and I hated it. something I'd rather not do again. If I can, you know, if I'm picked for every series, I'll be happy with that for the rest of my life. So, yeah, watching cricket, not that much fun, it turns out.
Now, what we love about this series is it's played over three different formats to win the Ashes. Have you got a favourite format?
Probably the ODIs. I love our format system. Being able to play all three different formats just makes it so competitive, and obviously trying to put your best team on the parks three different times. So for us, it's quite a condensed series. It's normally a little longer with longer time in between to adapt between the formats, but this just puts added pressure on it. And, you know, the team that adapts the quickest is going to be the one that wins. So I love the way we play the game. I think I would love to see the men's go in a similar direction one day, maybe for different kind of points. But, yeah, it's such a challenge to change between the formats, and that's something we really enjoy.
Yeah, and it means that the winner is the one that's got the best overall skill set, which I think it's a great setup. So you say that the 50 over is your favourite. What suits your game the best? Is it the 50 over, or do you think you're better as a test bowler or a T20 bowler? What do you think?
Definitely not better as a test bowler. That tests my patience, that's for sure. probably still the ODIs. I think you get a bit of all formats in ODI cricket. You've got a little bit of test at the start, just a little bit harder than usual with the, you know, a white rock and two out. But and then you've got the T20 component towards the back end. So I think you kind of get all the formats possible in an ODI game of cricket. So you kind of get every little bit of it. And I really enjoy that because I love bowling at every stage of the game. Opening is just as much fun as bowling at the death. So, I would say that ODI is my preferred format. As for what my figures are, I don't actually know. Probably T20, but it goes one way or the other in T20 cricket. I can have a great game or an absolute shocker.
Yeah, so let's focus on that the game today at 7:10 Adelaide. Check your local guides at the Adelaide Oval, Australia v England. The team today, Megan, who's going to be in it? Because we read all through the last couple of days that no longer is Elise Perrier a lay down for a spot in the T20 team, just with the way the policy has been evolved from a selection perspective and her sort of challenges, I suppose, from a continuity perspective with her training and preparation. She's not going to be there. Beth Mooney broke her jaw the other day. Bloody Maddie Mott's throwing rocks at people. What's the lineup going to look like?
That's a very good question. I often say the cliche line of I'd hate to be a selector, but I really would hate to be a selector right now. So I think we had a really good challenging day the other day against the Oz A girls. We've got incredible depth, and that's what's kind of scary, is anyone that slots in will just fit into that team willy-nilly. So I don't know. Look, for me, whenever I pick my team, I always pick one more bowler than I should. So probably not the best person to ask for that. But, not being able to have Beth is unfortunate. That was a crazy incident. I was actually batting next to her at the time and heard the impact. So that was pretty horrendous. And to turn around and see a bit of blood was pretty confronting. So unfortunate for her, but luckily we have somehow a whole team of left-handers to replace that opening slot. So it'll be interesting to see if we replace with another left-hander or if we bring in just another power hitter. I'm unsure how they're going to go. I think it'll be a bit situational on what the wicket they prepare at Adelaide Oval is.
Now, Gareth Hall, we know he does awesome stuff on RSN Central from 10:30 weekdays here on RSN 927, of course, does some great stuff on the weekends too, covering the racing across the country. But yesterday he had a one-on-one with Willie Pike. Now, Willie is synonymous with WA racing. He came across here for a little while, last couple of years, and done some things for the Peters family and has achieved many great things. And backing Willie in the last at Ascot's always a great way to finish your Saturday. Things have been a bit rough. But that won't be happening any longer because he's decided to come across to New South Wales to continue his riding career because of his vaccination status and the requirements in WA for him to be vaccinated, which he doesn't want to do. Now, he was asked about this yesterday as part of a wide-ranging interview. If you missed it and you're interested, I would suggest you go to the website. It's pretty good. Gareth did a bloody good job, as he always does. rsn.net.au, you can hear the whole thing, but I just wanted to play you these couple of snippets about how and why it's got to this point.
I guess the question everybody wants to know, Pike, is why won't you get vaccinated?
Well, it's probably more a question to sit down and you have a cup of coffee over. It's probably not something that you discuss on a radio show.
Yeah.
But I've got my own personal and private reasons for it, and I'll have a coffee with you one day and we can talk about it.
You're reluctant to get vaccinated because you had a flu shot 20 years ago and you had a bad reaction to that. Is that the main reason that you won't get vaccinated at the moment? I know that you said at the start of the interview we'll have a coffee and discuss all this, but I just thought after I read that, is that the main reason, or is there other reasons behind it as well, Pike? And you don't have to go into the other reasons if there is other reasons.
No, that is generally one of the main reasons why. So I said that if you want to, we'll delve into it one day over a coffee. But that is definitely one of the main reasons why. I wasn't sick. I tried to do preventative measures and got really sick. So it didn't add up in my mind to try that again.
Are you worried that if you do go to New South Wales, the rules might change, or is it just a situation where you're just going to take every day as it comes, in a way, Pikey?
Well, I sort of have to take every day as it comes. It's definitely a possibility that the situation will change, and, they're the rules. All I'm trying to do is stay within the rules. I'm not asking for anything special or anything like that. I'm just trying to stay within the rules, and the rules at the moment over in Sydney allow me to ride, so that's what I'm going to pursue.
That was part of the conversation yesterday with Gareth Hall and William Pike. He just kept calling him William all afternoon, all morning he did in that chat. Check it out at the website, rsn.net.au. Now, I bring that to your attention if you missed it yesterday, because we clearly know the whole Novak Djokovic scenario.
Is
but
he playing today, Djokovic? No,
I think he may have been sent packing.
Right, bundled out.
No, I think it was just sent packing. I think it was just sent packing. So we know that story very well. There's a bit more context to that from Pikey's perspective, with his history with immunisation that perhaps hasn't gone well for him, and that's, I could totally understand that would be a reason to hesitate when it comes to this perspective. But I also bring it up because it does give context, which is good. But Kelly Slater is a very good friend of the World Surfing League tournaments and events around Australia through the Easter period, the Bells and all that sort of stuff, and then gets the Margaret River every now and then and gets up the Gold Coast. But he is also not inclined to get himself vaccinated, and he's been told effectively that there is no chance, exemption otherwise, of him getting into Australia for upcoming events without being vaccinated, according to the federal government. So this is becoming a bit more of a fluid conversation in the Australian sporting circles. We know that some AFL players, the NRLs have got a slightly different bent on this. Peter Volandis is opening the doors to anyone who still wants to play, and that's okay by him. But the other reason I bring this up is Victoria Azarenka, as a member of the Tennis Players Council, has suggested the ATP and the WTA should mandate vaccinations for all players to be able to play anywhere across the globe. So not only is it a government issue and a border control issue, but it's becoming a conversation within competitors within competitions, that they want to make sure that they are doing the right thing, or having people who are participating in these events seen to be looking after the rest of the community.
Yeah, that's right. So in the tennis world, it's about 97% of the players, professional players, have been vaccinated.
That's pretty good.
So it's a pretty high amount. So as a result of that, this is where I think there needs to be strong leadership shown by the ATP or the WTA or Australian Open or whatever to say, well, you know what, we're going to mandate it. So we're going to take out all the need for government to get involved and all that sort of thing. And rather than get to almost take the soft option and say, well, we'd like him here, but, you know, it's up to the government and all that sort of thing, just take it out of the government's hands. And I think that goes across all sports, is that's if you've got such a strong percentage of your cohort, your playing cohort, that are prepared to do it, then I think it's a good thing to do. It's setting the right message, isn't it?
Well,
in the community?
It's certainly sending the right message in the community, if that's Well, it depends. For those that don't believe it, it's the wrong message.
This is the whole thing. Exactly. But if you've got a cohort that is 97% prepared to do it, I think it's... We don't want to get into sort of, you know, Neil Mitchell, sort of Virginia Trioli type areas but on this show, but because it is exhausting. But a lot of it does go down to leadership. I mean, you'd think in surfing, you know, that there'd be more likely to be people that are less likely to do it than other sports, wouldn't you?
They're
very sort of that sort of free, sort of spirited type of lifestyle.
Yeah, that's probably not far off. Yeah. Off the SMS, he's not staying within the rules. He's asking for special treatment. He's a sook. I don't agree with that because he's working within the parameters that have been set. WA, William is not allowed to participate, but New South Wales he is. So he's not asking for anything different. He's just allowed to go and participate there.
Yeah. See, the interesting thing for me is that, like, with Peter Volandis in his stance from an NRL perspective is that he kind of wants NRL players that are anti-vax to be able to play.
Yeah.
Now, that could happen in some states and not other states, or some venues, and like we've talked about this before. The interesting thing for me is that something came out yesterday where, and this was reported in The Age, that over half the AFL players in the eastern states have contracted COVID over the last period of time, last couple of months.
Yep.
That's a big, big percentage. And you just wonder whether...
Over half was the report.
Yeah. Because we were thinking initially maybe a week ago that could have been up to 100, but they're now saying over half.
Well, yeah, there's a story today about Emma Carney, who had it from the Kangaroos and the AFLW, saying the Star Roos is one of more than 100 AFL and AFLW players. There's more than 100 if there's over half of the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah. So,
about 250.
What I want to know, and please, I don't want this to happen, but in the NRL, someone who was able to keep playing and was not vaccinated and then got very sick as a result of having that quite public stance that I'm not going to get vaccinated, whether that would change the mind of the NRL and of Peter Volandis to say, no, we don't want to sort of encourage the anti-vaccination stance, because that is fundamentally one of the reasons why the government wanted Djokovic out of the country, because it would be seen as encouraging the anti-vaxxers that it's okay.
Seemingly in the end, it was the only reason he got kicked out.
Well, yeah. So, you know what I mean? So, look, I think it's, as I said, I don't like want to get bogged down in this program on these sorts of things, because it kind of, we want to kind of keep, it's like in the days of Chasey in the playground, or Tiggy of Bali, you know, that's what... why Bali? Yeah.
Well, because it was a nice place to rest.
I can think of better places.
You've Bali, never been to Bali.
But it was
how would you know?
It's a strange thing, though, isn't it? You're playing an intense game of Chasey, and all of a sudden you go, that Bali, can't touch me.
It's a nice place to rest. Stop and just regenerate.
It sort of
regenerate.
Ruins the game pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Recharge. Recharge in Bali.
Anyway, sorry, I got off the top.
But I do think, we'll move on from this, because we're going to get to Arthur Jones very shortly after the break. But I do think there's... Look, the way that it's all being dealt with is changing. So will vaccination be a requirement in 3 months?
Yeah, that's right.
Like all that, it will evolve.
No, I agree with you. We're not contact tracing anymore.
It's different. There's no PCRs unless you're dying. Like, well, it's a very different landscape. Yes. So in the community, so the sport will catch up to that at some point.
Yes, because it becomes a situation where it becomes more personal responsibility.
Yeah.
And it's up to you, because I think for a while there, to get the vaccination rate to a certain level, you kind of had to almost force people to do it to live a life. Now they've got to a level, it's like, well, okay, we've now got to this level. Now we're just going to say it's up to you. Yep. And that's a little bit like, and I think it has to be that way. How you live life. That now the personal responsibility is, if you want to protect yourself, there are opportunities for you to do that. If you don't, you run the risk. You run the risk of that. And then even if you are sick, the responsibility is you go away and then you can come back when you're well. Don't get your friends, your family, your work colleagues, put them in a vulnerable position.
Yep.
But it becomes your personal responsibility.
Arthur Jones playing for the Western Bulldogs, drafted pick number 43 in the draft just gone. The boy from Claremont joins us on the line. Arthur, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, you two.
We're great, mate. Nice to have you with us on the program. Now, my understanding is, we spoke to someone yesterday from WA who has been spending the summer in WA, has only been in Melbourne for a little while. How long have you been in Melbourne for?
as of last Sunday, a week.
Right. How are you finding it?
Fairly different. really exciting. Not much to say. Hey, just very excited to be over here finally, and I'm happy to take this opportunity with both hands.
Yeah, good on you. You're a elite speed. You've got great agility. There's not much of you. 65 kegs. Are you trying to put a little bit of weight on, or is this one of your assets that you're light and zippy, and that's your thing?
I'm trying to put on a little bit of weight, but also keep my speed, you know?
Yep.
I think I got drafted for my speed, so hopefully I could use my strength and use that as a weapon, and hopefully in a couple of months start playing AFL.
If you need some tips on how to put on some weight, Arthur, I'll give you my number afterwards, and I can give you a chat because I can have that got that covered for you.
Sure, mate.
I would suggest you don't put that number in your phone. So, what's training been like for you then? If you've been back in Perth doing your own things with some great help, but hanging out with the boys and doing the training the last week or so, what's that been like?
Very different to WA system. So the Waffle system is like, it's like the VFL system, but less training days. And
yep.
And basically after the draft, you kind of just wanted to be over here with the boys and train with the Bulldogs. But it just felt different. Like we had different volume sessions, different conditioning sessions than what the Bulldogs boys had here. And so I was completing the training sessions with Claremont, the team that I was with. And then after that, I had to do an extra 3-4 Ks just because I wasn't doing enough. And then last Thursday when I had my first session, that felt great. We only had a 8K session, but that 8Ks was a lot. due to different running tempo and different systems and different muscles getting activated, so it was very different, but wouldn't have it any other way.
For a Bulldog supporter who is listening to this interview, Arthur, when we say that you are a relation of the Cracker family or part of the Cracker family, a lot of people get really excited because of what the Crackers have been able to do over a long period of time. Explain the link to us.
Oh, it's we're really, really close. So my mother's mother, and my nan, is the Cracker brother's sister.
Ah, right. Yep.
So they're my pops. They're my great pops. And we're really, really close. So my mother grew up in Mount Barker, where they originated from. And then they were really close back then. And then obviously they moved to Melbourne for footy. And then when they came back, Mum was still there. So we still had that strong connection with them. And, they loved their little sister, which was my mum's mum. And then turned out they loved Mum. And then ended up they loved me. So it all worked out.
Fantastic.
Now, you're living with Jamara, I believe. So he knows a fair bit about walking into a pretty good team. How are you dealing with that?
Great, actually. You got to learn the different standards and just got to learn the different lifestyle. And to be honest, if it wasn't with Jamar, who I was living with, I would want to live with Bont. Like, just the way that they prep for each training session and the way they do their self-prep is outstanding.
I wonder what the buffet is looking like at Melbourne Park. Wonder if William Masur has been past it, or he's bringing his own. He's an organised sort of fellow. He's one of the greats of Australian tennis, and he joins us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Wally.
Hey, morning, guys. How are you?
We're going well, thanks. Is the buffet in operation, or you have to pack your own food?
Oh, look, I do both.
Great result.
I don't want to miss out.
What can I ask you? We're digressing a little bit, but it's a bit of fun. What's in the home pack that you take with you? What do you take from home?
Oh, the unhealthy options, the snacks. I'm doing a bit of commentary though, so you've got to kind of stay sugared up to keep, to keep going.
That's my excuse too.
What have you made so far of the first couple of days of play?
Well, I think the Australian Open deserved a break. So we've been lucky. We've had some, you know, really good weather and, you know, uninterrupted schedule. And, you know, the crowds are limited to 50% capacity, so it's slightly different feel, but we experienced that last year. But all in all, some really good tennis. You know, some, probably for me, just some, you know, working for Tennis Australia and performance, just a few close results that didn't go our way. That was a bit disappointing for some of the Australians, but overall, pretty good.
Yeah, so just from an Australian point of view, what stood out? I'll leave Ash to the side because she's just incredible with how she's going. What are the things that have captured your attention that from a positive point of view?
Well, from a positive point of view, I thought Alex Zimina, he showed some real signs. Late last year, he played his last match in the Davis Cup Finals. It was really solid, and then he sort of picked up where he left off. When he got to the ATP Cup, played really well, and gee, he was sharp the other night. He was moving so well that he actually came out of his shoe. I've never seen that before. his foot speed was so great that his foot came right out of the shoe, and he played three or four balls in his sock. That's how well he's going. But yeah, that was impressive. Obviously, Nick is pretty enigmatic. He didn't play the first 2 weeks of the season due to asthma, and then he had COVID, and then he comes out and plays the sort of tennis and puts on the sort of show that only he can put on. So that's going to be really interesting to see how he goes up against Medvedev tonight. He's just the most awkward player, I think, for any of the seeds to face in such an early round. So that's going to be a real blockbuster. And I'm sure Nick's going to provide plenty of surprises there. Yeah, so look, that was really positive, you know, in terms of our top players. We actually had some good results in the qualifying. I know we're into the main draw now, but we gave a lot of our young juniors an opportunity to play in the qualifying, and quite a few of them haven't travelled for years due to the COVID restrictions. And pros can get overseas, but it was very hard for juniors to get exemptions to play overseas, and a lot of the tournaments were cancelled. So they got a run in the qualifying, and we had a bunch of juniors win matches in the first round of qualifying. And, you know, you recognise that players in qualifying have rankings inside the world's top 250. So that was really encouraging. Madison Inglis, won her first round against the US Open finalist. So, yeah, there's been some good things. And probably two things that disappointed me were Jordan Thompson losing in five and Alexei Poprin losing in five. They, you know, they both train really hard. They've got great potential to do well in a slam, but, yeah, just didn't fall their way.
There was great hope for Thanasi Kokkinakis, Wally, after his win in Adelaide last week, and the story of him and having to work so hard to get back to full fitness and health and missing so much tennis through the last 5 years or so, for probably even more for Thanasi. But it was always going to be, was it always going to be challenging for him to back that, the emotion of Adelaide last week, to progress through into the second week or into the first couple of rounds of the Australian Open?
Yeah, there's the emotion, and obviously, you know, Thanasi's injuries have been well documented. You know, he's not lost nearly 3 to 4 years through glandular fever and shoulder surgery and all sorts of problems. But I think as much as the emotional, you know, dealing, you know, kind of resetting for the Australian Open, I think the conditions were quite different. And I just think he just couldn't adjust within 24 hours because he literally only had one day in between winning the final on Saturday night and playing on Monday. He just needed more time on the court. He didn't get it. But the tour's a bit like that. You know, when lightning strikes, you've just got to be in the right place at the right time. And he got a lot of points in Adelaide. He's on the cusp of 100 in the world, which gets him into all the slams. So you've got to take the wins when they arrive. And, you know, that's a learning curve. If he's in that situation again, he'll be more knowledgeable about how to go about preparing for the next big match after a tournament victory, hopefully.
Does it feel like a normal Australian Open now, obviously, with all the dramas in the build-up? It's still, life's still not normal, but it's a little bit more normal than it was last year when the tournament was played a little bit later. What's it like walking around in the corridors and being on court at the moment?
Well, when I've been commentating some matches and obviously going to watch some of the matches, and when you're in those outdoor courts, you know, Margaret Court Arena, court number 3, for example, it's rocking. You know, there's a great atmosphere. So you're not aware necessarily of the 50% crowd capacity. Where you do notice it is just walking around the ground.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's really heaving here normally at the Australian Open. But, guys, I'm approaching 60, and I like the quiet. You know, I like it. You know, I can find a chair. I can have a cup of tea under a gum tree. It's perfect.
Ash, Clearly the headline act from Australian tennis perspective through the next 10 days or so. She's had a pretty soft start to the tournament. Is that a positive or a bit of a concern for you, Wally?
No. I think it's Ash had a great year last year, obviously. She had some decent time off at the end of the year, which is a positive, and then she could really build up into the preseason. Goes to Adelaide, got the matches under her belt. I think it's the perfect start for Ash, to be honest. And she's such a, the thing that I'm just so impressed with Ash is just how versatile she is. So one of the great problems, of course, in tennis is the different styles of opponent you can play from day to day. And that can be unsettling, but she's not a one-dimensional player. She's just got so much versatility that she can seem to sort of diffuse most of the problems. And I guess unlike some Australian players who I felt, our Grand Slam winners, they could never find their very best tennis at the Australian Open. I don't think that's going to be the problem for Ash, whether this year or next in the years to come. I think she's going to take this title.
Imagine waiting 82 first-class games to make your test debut. Imagine that test debut being at the mighty MCG, your home venue, and then imagine as part of that experience, you dominate proceedings for your country, you win a test match, and in the second dig, you take 6-7. That's the storyline for Scotty Boland in the last month or so. I wonder how he's feeling. He joins us on the line. Scotty, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Great to have you with us, mate. Are you fat-arming it down Chapel Street, hanging out of a Lamborghini at the moment after what you've been through? Is that where you are now?
No, I'm just heading home quickly to see the kids while we're for a couple of hours while we're in the Big Bash bubble now.
Ah, of course. Yes. What?
Yeah.
Have you comprehended what's happened, Scotty, in the last month? It's been quite remarkable.
Yeah, it's been an amazing few weeks. No, probably not really. If you said any of this was going to happen probably 2 months ago, I wouldn't have believed you. But it's been amazing.
Did you think this was possible? It's one thing to do it. It's one thing to dream that you think you can do it. Take us through what you're thinking about it as you reflect back on this last couple of months.
I probably didn't think I could do it. I probably thought I'd be a chance to. I definitely thought I could play a test match or put my name up in there to be around that mark. And then, the conversations I've had with George Bailey over the last probably 3 or 4 months have been pretty positive. And then, once the squad got announced, he was pretty adamant that I was going to be added in for the Melbourne and Sydney legs of the test series. So, they definitely stayed true to their word.
And then to live it, Scotty, what was the thing that maybe surprised you the most? And what was the thing that you enjoyed the most? Not just the wickets, obviously, but going that from that first class bowler that you've been so successful for such a long time to being a test bowler.
I've obviously really enjoyed all support I've had from the crowd. The MCG was going nuts on that night of day two and the morning of day three. I was incredible. A few of the guys said they hadn't heard of a role like that for quite a few years, so that was pretty special. And the work I've done over probably the last 6 or 7 years, the way I prepare for games and stuff like that, to know it's really keep me in good stead and helps me perform at the next level, it means I'm on the right track, I think.
So do you think you bowl better, or it's just carrying that level that you've been able to perform with for Victoria for a long time, and even some of the bowling innings you're able to do just recently for Victoria, it was at a high level. Did you go again to another level, or did you just hold that level?
I'm not sure. It's pretty hard to tell. I think in the first innings I was obviously pretty nervous, and the ball didn't come out as well as I would hope. And then after having a really good chat with Andrew McDonald at the lunch break on day one, he just thought I was sort of bowling a bit safe and just trying to sort of put the ball in a nice area instead of really bowling a ball and trying to bowl a real heavy ball, which I do when I'm bowling well. It's what's coming out of my hand for Victoria. So, we tried to simplify it there, and then, the last 2 weeks, the ball's been coming out as well as it ever has, I reckon.
Well, the figures would suggest that. The 6 for 7 was pretty good, and the second dig at Melbourne, but 4 for 36, 3 for 30 in Sydney, 1 for 33 and 3 for 18. With, at this stage in your international test career, 18 wickets at 9.55 at 2.11 runs and over. They're ridiculous numbers, Scotty. Now, it's going to be tough to back that up, I reckon. But do you harness the energy that the cricketing public has given you? Do you use that, or is it something that doesn't fuel you at all? You've got your own things that you want to achieve through your system and your execution and your preparation, that sort of thing.
It's awesome to have the support. And, I was quite lucky going to Sydney, had the same support in Hobart as well. It was really nice. But when I'm at the top of my mark, I'm pretty focused on what I want to do. And a lot of the times I'm not hearing the crowd or hearing external noises like that. So it's sort of funny, really, when I go down the fine leg or go down and field a ball somewhere that I sort of recognise the crowd. But when I'm at the top of my mark, I'm pretty focused on what I need to do.
What's it like to win a test match for you, not just you personally, but although you did, but with your team, to win a test match for your country? Obviously, you won plenty of matches in first-class cricket and one day and all that sort of stuff. But if you win a test match for your country, what's that feeling like? What's it like in the rooms after that and the energy that flows with that?
That first one that I was a part of in Melbourne was to win the series. So, the change rooms were... very exciting place to be. And then, we sang the song on the ground and, that was all pretty special. And then with the finish being pretty early, all our families could come across from the team hotel and enjoy the afternoon out in the G, which was, something that a lot of guys will never forget, having their kids run around and playing cricket and, just mucking around the G. It was pretty special.
Even just talking to us now, or I saw you at the MCG last night in the purple of the Hurricanes, walking around the G, and all these young kids are wanting to come up and get their photograph with you and have a chat to you. Can you actually still believe it? Has it actually settled in yet?
Not really. I still find it a little bit embarrassing that I'm sort of getting a bit more... I'm getting a lot more recognised than I was 2 months ago, but, it's something that... I didn't think was going to happen, and then two, now it's happened that, I'm not really sure how to put that in the words.
Now, we've got a good text here that is, it's given me all your stats for Frankston Peninsula. You've got a bowling average for Frankston Peninsula of 23.66, and your test average is 9.56. and it made me think about the people that have had such a big effect on you, that you sort of reflect on, that has got you to this point to be an Ashes hero. Who are some of the people that have had that influence on your career, Scotty, that you now look back on and kind of want to thank?
From the start of my career at Frankston, I sort of rocked up as an all-rounder that bowled a little bit, and then within probably 2 years, I was like a bowler that could sort of bat a little bit. So my role changed pretty quickly, and it was probably thanks to Dave McLean, who was probably my first real bowling coach when I got to Frankston. I remember the first game I played for Frankston, I bowled about 7 or 8 no balls in a one-day game, so I didn't really have a run-up. And then, through that, I've had lucky enough to play under Nick Jewell, who was fantastic captain and really good for my bowling, and sort of took me into a lot of state trainings to net bowl to guys and sort of get my name out there. And then, I've had Shaw Graff, who was a bowling coach at Frankston for a few years as well. And then for like probably the last 10 years of my career, I've worked really closely with Mick Lewis, who's been amazing for me. He knows my bowling so well that in a game, if he feels that something's off, he can just tell me something really quickly, and I'm sort of able to adjust that now. And I've had some great coaches over the last 10 years, but he's probably been the one that I've worked the closest with.
And I guess, Scotty, the thing that I'm most proud of for you is that you've got your opportunity to be in the spotlight now, because for so long for Victoria, you've had so many great players around you that have that have played for Australia, Peter Siddall, James Pattinson. I know you're close to Johnny Holland that's had that opportunity, but you've seen so many people close to you that have had that chance and you've sort of been in the shadows despite your record to now have that opportunity. I can't imagine just how proud you must be for yourself.
Yeah, it's fair. Obviously, yeah, very proud, and yeah, my family's very proud as well. I've had so many messages from past players and past teammates.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.